Hi everyone and welcome to the Perma Podcast. I am James Prescott, your host, and welcome. And I'm delighted to welcome back a friend of this podcast, one of my first ever guests actually, 4 years ago when I started the show. Sarah Bessie, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad to be back again.
Yeah, this is the third, we were just talking, this is the third time you've been on, I think, but the last time was quite a while ago.
It has been too long.
Yeah, you should come on the show more often. Absolutely.
I'll try to keep from giving you any grief about that. But
yeah, and nothing else, we can just talk about Doctor Who.
Absolutely, I would not be mad about it. The new trailer just dropped this week.
Yeah, that's going to be my first question. You know, the most important topic. What did you think of the new Doctor Who trailer?
It looked very exciting. There were so many moments where I can't wait to see what's attached to the larger story, but it looked very exciting. I do feel like they're really getting into, really trying to connect with the 10th Doctor.
Feel and look
and an energy.
Yeah.
And that really felt very clear to me. Like, it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be a fun series, I think, this time around. And of course, anytime I get to see Jodie Whittaker in a tuxedo, I'm here for it. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, and it's funny because I was thinking that exact thing about 10. Like, there's an episode, rewatching the last series, and there's an episode, the episode with the witches. I was totally picturing David Tennant in that episode, like, doing all of that. It was just really strange, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a fun thing to be able to do, just almost to picture each one of the incarnations in whatever story it is.
And see
that similar, you know, energy and time sometimes. There's a lot of moments, especially in Peter Capaldi. I love Peter Capaldi as a doctor.
Yes.
And the tone shift, though, between that and what happened with the new doctor was, I think, necessary. Like, it was fun again. Yeah. My kids re-engaged again in a different way. So if Peter Capaldi was for us grown-ups, I feel like Jodie Whittaker is a reminder that this is also, at the end of the day, something that's supposed to be for a whole family or for all ages.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I was so pleased when she got the role as well.
She's perfect for it. She's just done a great job. And all the companions, I really like all the new companions as well. So we're very excited. We are a little bit disappointed there's no Christmas Day episode.
Yeah.
We'll try to hang in there.
Yeah. Actually, one of the final thing on Doctor Who, everyone's been doing this like 10 years, 2009 to 2019. Somebody did one with Doctor Who, which was absolute genius, which was a photo of David Tennant and Jodie Whittaker together. Like, the Doctor 10 years. I thought it was brilliant. I was like, yeah, that was fantastic.
My version of it, I tried to do it, and I had the two photos next to each other, and I was like, wait a minute, this looks like that See What You Look Like When You're Old app.
Yes.
I don't think I want to do it anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember that.
But the young people have their glow ups. Those of us who are in our 40s, we don't want
to. No, we don't want to know what you look like when we get older. We're already a little bit older.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes, my niece and nephew haven't mentioned the olden days yet, so I'm hoping they don't do that for a while. But, yeah.
Mum, did they have this when you were young?
Yeah.
No, actually, we didn't have to ride in a horse and wagon. We're fine.
So you've just released a new book, called Miracles and Other Reasonable Things, which I think is a brilliant title.
Thank you.
It's just like, it's miracles and then other reasonable things. Like, just, yeah, there's just a kind of paradox in that title, and it's a really powerful story, and I don't really think I can sum it up in a couple of sentences, but it's a story of, the title kind of sums it up. Tell us a bit of the story behind the book, how it kind of came about, and just a bit about the book without obviously giving everything away, but yeah.
I know, there's a lot of little twists and turns and moments in there. I think that's one of the things that I realized when I was writing, is that it's a very weird book. Definitely got some aspects that are, I think, pretty woo-woo for a lot of people. I think one of the things that, when I think about the book, so the actual story itself, it's been about 4 years since I wrote my last book. Mm. And this is a very big departure, this book, from my first two. My first one was Jesus, yeah, Feminist, and then the second was the book called Out of Swords. And both of those were books that took, like, a larger theological idea, you know, whether it was Christian feminism or the idea of faith deconstruction. And then, even though I used memoir and storytelling throughout it, it was really about interacting with those ideas, whereas this book is more about the actual story.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, you know, theological exploration around miracles and healing and what it means even to learn and unlearn God. But really, it is definitely more of a memoir sort of book, which I don't know that I will ever do again, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
It was a good experience this time. It was a joy to write, even though the content was is at times, you know, heavier or, I don't know, I guess in some ways you need the shadow to see the light.
Absolutely.
Here. And so I do feel like there's a hopefulness to it. But it explores basically what the last, you know, years since my last book have been about, because I had a major car accident and had a new baby and, you know, was kind of going through a lot of physical changes and have developed chronic illness and, you know, a few other things that have kind of changed how I show up in the world. And then, as a matter of fact, it usually ends up kind of being a chance to become an altar where you can meet with God.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a lot of ways, you know, it's definitely a very personal story. And I think one of the things, too, with it is that I've always been pretty almost jokey about the fact that I'm one of those, like, happy, clappy, charismatic Christians, that I'm really into the Holy Spirit and, you know, kind of making jokes at it, you know, now and again. It's this open secret sort of thing. But this is the first time I've kind of pulled the curtain back on what that actually means for me, or what, how that shows up in my life, or how I experience the activity and intimacy of the Holy Spirit in my own faith journey, which isn't something that I see reflected back thoughtfully to me a whole lot, oftentimes, in the type of writing that you and I do. A lot of times it can be, you know, one version of the story or the other, and neither one really felt reflective of the complexity of how I encounter both the Holy Spirit, but also the idea of miracles, the idea of healing, the idea of shalom, and how those things, you know, kind of can have a chance to show up in our actual lives. And so, you know, it was a lot of fun to write. I think one of the best things I'm hearing from people about it is that they pick it up and they don't put it down until it's done. That they just kind of slide right into the story and read it all the way through, or read it in a weekend, or, you know, can't really put it down. There's just nothing better to
totally
hear,
my experience,
you know, as a writer, than an enjoyable experience for people.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that probably sums it up. It's probably more words than you needed, but.
No, it's great for you to kind of unpack the book a little bit. I mean, I found it fascinating because of reading it from my own perspective, my own kind of journey. I've been on a bit of a, anyone who's listened to this podcast will know, because I talk about it a lot, a kind of journey of into grief and trauma, and finding a healthy response to it rather than an unhealthy one, which I'd had for 15 years, kind of journeying out of religious certainty and all of that kind of thing, and actually taking down all the structures in my life I used to cover for it, and in a sense, it included fundamentalist progressive Christianity. I had to leave, like you have recently, I think. I had to leave a Vineyard church. And I think it was for similar reasons as well, actually, that I left. So for me, it was really challenging, because I've read this book and I've been struggling with, does God answer prayer? Is God an interventionist God? Should I even trust God anymore? How can I... Does God really perform miracles? Like, I don't have faith for that anymore. I don't know how to pray anymore, because all the language I use to pray is kind of painful for me. So there was, when I was reading it, it was kind of bittersweet, because when you read the stories and the miracles that are in the book, it's kind of really encouraging. And it's like, wow, this is amazing. And this really happened. and I completely believe that it happened. And yet there's this, and then there's kind of this, and I'm sure this is a, this the case for a lot of other people who've read this book as well, like that, like, well, yeah, but this doesn't feel true to me. Like, mm-hmm. So what do I do with this? Like, this happens, so what do I do with this? is that what you found in terms of responses from the book?
I think so. I think in a lot of ways, even the book mirrors that experience, because for every experience of something that feels like God breaking through or feels like answered prayer, perhaps, there is a counter story for that, right? And so I think that that's the thing that is the complexity that I was wanting to explore, and perhaps that's the reason why it's more of a story-driven book as opposed to a prescriptive one, is that there is an absence of formula. And there is an absence of guarantees and of here's how God works or doesn't work. And I think that's the thing that you and I have encountered over the last number of years, is that every time we try to construct some sort of box for God, you know, this is where God is, this is how God shows up, this is how prayer works, this is how church should be, or whatever else it is, God somehow will meet us there and yet transcend that at the same time. So even in those places that I got to where I was like, there are no such thing as miracles. God does not answer prayer. You know, this is, you know, that's not what this is. So, I mean, and again, a lot of this is coming from the context of, you know, growing up in an initial introduction to faith and the faith tradition that looked at miracles as certain, as to be expected and demanded even.
Yeah.
Right? And then how you live longer than a hot second and you realize that is not how this works.
Yep.
But then ending up on the flip side of being like, well, then there's nothing, right? There are no miracles. There is no, what's the point of prayer? What's the point of, you know, does God even, you know, is that nothing but, you know, imaginations and, you know, manipulations even? And I couldn't even remain in that box, right? Because even that got transcended and invited, you know, in terms of where God is at. I think that my hope was that it was a book for those of us who find ourselves with a lot of unanswered prayers.
Yeah.
And a lot of unanswered questions. Kate Bowler uses the phrase those of us who are on the losing side of life. And that even if there is a possibility still of miracles, a possibility still of divine encounters, what does it look like to expand that definition, that to include those of us who maybe have a body or a life or a history or a story that doesn't cooperate with that dominant narrative?
Yeah, that's right. And
you know, one that makes room for grief.
That's right. I mean, that's it. I mean, this is something I've been reflecting on a lot, and I'm doing a series on the podcast on grief soon, and because I feel like grief is at the heart of everything, like everything at its heart is kind of grief. You know, we grieve culturally, we grieve, we don't learn how to grieve properly, and that's part of the problems in our world today, is that we don't know how to grieve the loss of our cultural identity or the changing of the times, or you know, and we just don't learn how to grieve well, and then we bottle it all up and deal with it very badly. And there's certainly an element of grief to your story, in so many ways, because there's kind of a grieving of, without going into detail, there's the grieving of a life that you felt almost that you'd lost after the car crash, and the implications of all of that, and just coming to terms with that, or just about coming to terms with it. And then going to a place and finding something miraculous out of the blue, which is, incredible. And I find that interesting because you went to Rome. And so it was the Catholic, and you went to meet the Pope, which is kind of cool.
As one does.
I actually read that when I first read the line, and then I went to meet the Pope, and it was like, oh, right.
It's a bit of a record scratch,
I was like, I didn't expect that.
Especially when you come from a tradition like mine that is like the lowest rung on a low church ladder, right? Like,
I mean, I come from a Methodist Anglican background, So I've never been involved with the Catholic Church at all. But I just found it really interesting that it was in that place that you met with God again and had some healing, and had just all these divine encounters while you were there that were just so. And I remember you talking about it in the book that you'd almost got used to the fact that you would just meet these random people in thousands. When thousands of people were around, you just meet these same people again and again and again. And it was, and it just reminded me, because I ended up, when I left my spiritual community, my church, a couple of years ago nearly, I found a new spiritual community in a place I wasn't expecting to find it. Exactly the same way. So there was some solidarity there, I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that's just it. Is even that whole section in the book that happens in Rome felt, it was funny to me, because like you live through something, and then it almost takes a few turns around the sun before you really fully understand it.
Yeah.
And you know, even from a relationship perspective, you know, my husband and I have been together for more than 20 years. And my role in our relationship has always been the woo-woo spiritual one, right? I'm the one who's hearing from Jesus all the time. For sure, you know, I'm sure has its own baggage for him. But, you know, and he's always been the one that's a more steady I don't want to say suspicious, but he has his own story around a lot of these things, around the language of miracles, around the language of the miraculous. And is a skeptic in a lot of ways. And when we entered into Rome, it was almost like we switched our approach, where I felt very skeptical. I felt very cynical. I felt very much like arms folded, but like really here, like these guys, you know. And he just had such more openness and willingness. And so it was almost the conduit or the open door for things that I was, to be honest, too prideful, right, to really have an openness to. And I think then that helped on the other side of Rome, because, again, it feels kind of like this fulcrum in the middle of the story of this life before and after that. But after is not the happily ever after, which I think is what a lot of books that talk about miracles or talk about this big intervention or big moment with God, the implication is, and then they lived happily ever after.
Yeah.
And that's not at all what was the story for us on the other side of that experience. And so I think in a lot of ways, that's the part that I was headed towards with the book the whole time. It was more than just chaos, you know, and then, you know, a reordering or a healing or a miraculous encounter, you know, in Rome of all places. Which, you know, is a great story. But that last back half of the book about the, you know, the what happens after is probably more important and more tender to me than any encounter with any pontiff, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is, that's so true. And I've talked to various people about this for the show, that who've written books along similar themes. And it's one of the things that keeps coming up, and I'm definitely going to try and bring into my next book, is there is no happy ever after. It doesn't exist. You know, it's kind of an invention of Hollywood and evangelical Christianity, like the happy ever after thing. You know, it's it's like one part of the journey ends, and then there's another thing that just jumps up, like.
Right.
I've fallen for this trap so many times. Like, I get to this point, and I'm like, finally, I've dealt with all this. And then something else comes up, and it's like, wasn't I done with this? You know? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I did it again.
Yeah.
You know?
I think in a lot of ways it mirrors Dr. James Fowler's stages of spiritual formation.
Yeah.
And it is almost, in a way, a path you walk over and over. And in some ways, you don't realize... I think that this is, you know, again, you know, from my perspective, I think that oftentimes those experiences of being in the wilderness or feeling disoriented or realizing that the internal prosperity gospel you have somehow, you know, connected in your heart of if this, then that, or if this happens, then this will happen, or, you know, this is how it always is. But that invitation out of that can feel disruptive and terrifying. But it is almost always, I believe, at the invitation of the Holy Spirit. Because there is then, I mean, a lot of people would look at it and say, well, if there's no happily ever after, then what's the point? But even that is a childish way of looking at what life is, right? What the possibilities are. Like Buechner says, this, here's the world. It's beautiful and terrible things will happen. Do not be afraid. In a lot of ways, you know, we want the beautiful without the terrible, but that's what makes them hold hands. It's the same way with grief and hope. Yeah. It's the same way with light and shadow. I mean, these are the things that you need. You don't fully understand or are not able to fully enter into without the counter story.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And I think the response that I found, which is healthy, is instead of when what's called people deconstruct, is not to just reconstruct in a way where you're just rebuilding a new, the same thing with new language, but you actually build a structure where it allows you to go into your pain and out again without your pain controlling you.
That's beautifully said. And beautifully put. I think that that's just it. I think a lot of times, I mean, I see this oftentimes, you know, I lead a community with a couple of friends called Evolving Faith that specifically is for people who are in a season of deconstruction and wanting to reconstruct. And one of the things that I have seen from just, and again, this is just from like a pastoral perspective, is that it's disorienting and scary when you start to unlearn the things that you used to know for sure. And oftentimes there's a threshold, right? There's a threshold that we come to, and it can feel very intellectual for a really long time, right? We could be talking you know, sit with your, you know, your IPA at the pub with your buddies and be like, oh, let's talk about atonement theory. You know, it's really exciting, you know, but then you kind of come to that threshold, and what really launches you into it is grief, you know, which is part of the reason why I think what you're doing is so incredibly important in terms of having this conversation for people, is that even when you don't want to, that is the thing that propels you into that new reality of disorientation. And so then you're afraid and you're sad and you're scared. And so you just madly try to reconstruct something, right?
Yeah, and absolutely.
Oftentimes that hurry is what wounds you even further, because you are still using the tools that created that thing you needed to dismantle. And that's how you end up oftentimes in, you know, say, for instance, the more progressive Christian spaces where you and I do a lot of our work in ministry, is that you end up with very progressive fundamentalists.
Yes. Oh, you know, yes. And they're the worst. Yeah.
Maybe it's different ideas, but you still have the same practices of you know, purity tests and, you know, those sorts of things. And so even though your opinions have changed, you fundamentally haven't actually changed.
Yes, that's right.
And so that's what rushing does, right? It just creates another. Maybe you've got different ideas, but you're still the same tools. Yeah. You're still the same structure.
Yeah.
You haven't actually been transformed or renewed on the inside.
And the real shift to me was not changing what I believed, it was changing how I believed.
There it is.
Like, how I held my beliefs. Like, am I going to listen to other people's stories who I disagree with and just, like, not judge them and not like silence them and list and love my enemies and, you know, kind of all that kind of thing that Jesus told us to do or am I going to just live in my little progressive bubble and just kind of, like, you know,
well, congratulate yourself on being more enlightened than everybody else.
Exactly. And
listen, we've all been there, right?
We have all done it.
Absolutely. And so it's not like it's, you know, something that is, I think I speak from a lot of years of being in that space, right? Of, it's a journey of forgiveness. And I think that that stage of learning to forgive even yourself for how you were able to even continue on, I think in a lot of ways is key. I mean, again, most of us are doing the best we can, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that there's grace for that. But I think that that's why it's good to have room for the slowing down, right? Not needing to rush to reconstruct something or rebuild something just because you're afraid and uncomfortable or disoriented, right? But instead, like you were saying with grief, that you actually go walk through it, right? That it isn't something you get to jump over or skirt around without doing profound damage to your soul. But the leaning in to the pain is counterintuitive, which is why I think there has to be an invitation from God in that.
Yeah, there does. Oh, absolutely, yeah. And my experience was that there was a clear moment where that happened. Like, there was a tipping point. Like, I was at a home group, and I don't remember what we were talking about, but I just, and I've told this story loads of times. People who listen to my show must be bored of me telling this story. But I I was sitting on a sofa, and just stuff started coming out of me, words, and I felt physically bound to that sofa while this stuff was coming out of me. And it wasn't just words, it was energy and pain and everything, and it was just like a pressure valve, you know. And a few weeks later, I had a picture of and a word. Gosh, I haven't used that phrase for a long time.
Listen, I'm here for it, so come on.
And just like, are you going to go into this valley or not? Like, this is going to be painful. Like, and I just like said, look, I've got to go there. I don't have a choice. I know what's going to happen. I know it's going to get worse before it gets better. But I have to go there. If I don't, something inside me is going to die. So, and it was everything I expected it to be. longer than I expected, but better than I expected, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it becomes truer and deeper.
Yeah.
Than you could have imagined, I think, in a lot of ways. I mean, a lot of times we have found, you know, not only in my own experiences, but in talking to other people who have walked through something very similar, and almost every spiritual teacher has some sort of phrase. I use the phrase wilderness. I like it better than deconstruction. It sounds more organic.
I love that phrase. Yeah, I do.
But deconstruction is helpful, right? It's a helpful metaphor for sure. But I think one of the things that we often feel when we kind of come to those places, whether for me, you know, with what happened, you know, physically, or even I would argue even over this last year, as you know, we've been walking our own path of grief and loss.
Yeah.
You have this sense of, you know, you almost feel like there's just this binary, right, where your options are that you either just stick your fingers in your ears and pretend everything is fine and double down, right? You just double down on everything that you think you know about God, and, you know, here's the way that God always works. Here's the formulas. I'm going to use them. Like, listen, I'm just going to go all in on the way that I was taught to be in this space. Or you feel this need to just burn down everything, right? Walk away from everything. Let everything disintegrate. There's nothing to be redeemed here. There's nothing to be resurrected. And it can feel like there's just salt in the field. And I think that we all feel both of those urges at the same time sometimes, and we'll choose different paths depending on where we are, and Lord knows I've walked both of them. But I feel like that's where the invitation of attention comes in, around the wilderness, around the invitation of relearning God. It has a sense of pilgrimage to it. Right? It has this sense of a forward leaning in, going through. And that to me is the invitation of the wilderness, right? Jonathan Martin always says that the wilderness is always the birthplace of intimacy with God. Mm. And I think it's because you have everything stripped away.
Yeah.
Right? All the things that you would normally use to say, here's what I believe, here's how God always works, or all the things you would have doubled down on, or even your anger and your rage or your defiance of burning it all down.
Yeah.
Having all those things set aside means that you're meeting with God, you know, without a veil before your face. And that's, you know, that's serious good work.
Yeah. It is, yeah. And I do love that metaphor of the wilderness. And something I keep saying to people is that the wilderness is not a solitary place.
No.
You know, it's like loads of people are there.
Listen, this is so much fun with the nature of my work, is almost being able to set up feasts in the wilderness.
It's yes.
Like, oh, no, wait. You know, and there's this one image that I can't remember where I heard it. All of a sudden, and I'm going to just kick myself later that I couldn't properly credit this, but talks about how it's not the wilderness anymore when you start to find oasis. And that's oftentimes what you find when you're in this space without expectation or demand or formula, and you find each other in that space. It feels like oasis, and it feels like a feast, and that is, it's, you know, it is a hell of a lot of fun. is good work, and it's freeing. But there still is a sense of pilgrimage to it that I like.
Yeah, there is, and there, yeah, I think that's another great metaphor for the journey. I think that so many people have been on in the last few years. I think more and more people. One of the words that I use to describe it has been regeneration,
which I feel love it.
Yeah, like, it was seriously. I was like, oh my word, this. Like, I've got another friend who loves Doctor Who as much as you. And we hung out last Christmas, my birthday, we hung out, and I was talking about the word regeneration, and it was like, oh, wow, this word is so apt for me, for my journey, for this kind of, because deconstruction isn't sufficient, and, you know, it's a bigger journey than just taking things down, mm-hmm. and regeneration, especially with, you know, my love for Doctor Who, we felt like such a great metaphor. It's like the shedding of the old and the taking in of the new and staying true to who you are at the same time, mm-hmm. and discovering new parts of yourself, which is exactly what that process is about, especially in the show.
I love that metaphor. I like the idea that I think, especially in light of, like, when you think about Matt Smith's regeneration into Peter Capaldi, you really see that dynamic in that particular regeneration because the sense of that you always remember who you were, you carry that forward, and that you love that person. Not in the way that, like, David Tennant did, where it's like, I don't want to go, I'm fighting this with every bit of me. But the sense of wistfulness and sorrow and grief to it, and yet hope. And knowing that you're carrying that forward, that you still are the person who you were then, and that person is still with you and still inside of you, and you still carry all of those, and you can deal tenderly with your old self just the same way you would deal tenderly with anyone else whom you loved, with care and compassion and empathy, while still recognizing, and now this is who I'm moving forward as. And that, I think that's a beautiful metaphor, James. I love that.
Thank you. And that will be in my new book. I'm trying to get it into the title if I can, but we'll see. One of the things that really struck me was you go through this wilderness experience and deconstruct and everything, and you kind of come out and you're still, and unlike a lot of people, you're still using the language of the church. You're still talking about the Holy Spirit. You're still talking about, you know, all these kind of things that you were talking about before, but there's a different perspective to them. Obviously, there's a different, viewpoint. There's a different heart behind it. So I'm curious as to how you manage to keep hold of those things which you loved so much about Jesus and about the church, and didn't lose those in the process of losing so much other stuff in terms of your journey.
That's a great question. You know, I don't know that too many people have ever asked me that before, actually, James. That's a great question.
Well, thank you.
My first instinct is to say to your stubbornness, but super helpful to anybody. you know, I'm reminded of this. There was a moment, my friend Rachel Held Evans and I, when we were planning Evolving Faith the first time a couple years ago, and we were talking about wanting to kind of just see if there was room for that conversation. We have had, you know, in our own personal experiences, but then also in our work and ministry, we had learned that that season of wilderness or regeneration is not shepherded super well in the church. And both of us, having walked through that process, we love the language of the church. Rachel's book, Searching for Sunday, is specifically, you know, structured around the sacraments. Right?
Yeah.
And that was something that we unapologetically knew about each other and about the work that we wanted to do, but it was something that surprised us on the other side of the first gathering we had, because some of the feedback that we got from people was, whoa, this is super Jesus-y. Like, I was not expecting how Jesus-y it was. And I think that feedback surprised us because we were both like, well, we're both super Jesus-y. Like, I don't know how this was a surprise to anybody. But I think that's because a lot of people do have this sense of your evolving past language that once meant a lot to you. And our approach to it was, I think, more that regeneration approach. What does it mean to carry and still say, I want that language? I don't want to cede it only to the people who are Christian nationalists and evangelical or, you know, fundamentalists even. What does it look like to say, I want words like sin and sanctification and Holy Spirit and powers and principalities? I want the language of the miraculous. I love my Bible. And that's why I want to hold on to Scripture. I want to hold on to Jesus. But what does it look like to do that in a way that has been rebaptized, I think, in a lot of ways? And both Rachel and I had that approach to our work. I think that's what drew us to each other and drew us towards what we were trying to do with Evolving Faith. And I see that being very key. Like I said, some of it may be stubbornness, just that we didn't want to give up on things that were precious to us. And in a lot of ways, I felt and still feel like there's room for me in those words. There's room for me in that story. And I'm not willing to give up on the church. I'm not willing to give up on intentional community. I'm not willing to give up on these concepts and words and say that somehow they're smaller than the God of the universe. I think that there's a room to stretch and move. I think that they're more; those words are more elastic than we realize. They're stronger and more muscular, but flexible. And I think there's a room. They're bigger tent words than I think that we have been maybe led to believe. There's possibility within them. And a big part of me, you know, for instance, at the end of Evolving Faith, one of the things that we felt very strongly about was having communion. So we did. We had, you know, a massive communion service with thousands of people, which is a logistical nightmare to pull off, but we managed to do it. And the reason why is because we saw how important it was to have that metaphor at the table and that everybody was welcome at it. And that experience of serving communion alongside of other people, to people who had been told that there was no room for them at the table. Whether it was because of their sexual orientation or it was because of their political beliefs or it was because of their theological position. And instead to say, no, we're going to reclaim Eucharist, we're going to reclaim the table and say there is room for everyone here and we are not in charge of the guest list, was healing. It was redemptive. It felt defiant. And part of, I think, what we wanted and what I think, you know, probably leads towards the, that's a lot longer answer than you probably wanted to have, I apologize, but.
It's a great answer.
Yeah, there was this sense of, like, defiant reclamation, but also healing to it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely,
like,
yeah.
Not too many words, but.
I think that's a beautiful thing that you were able to do that, you know, because I know that's one of the things I found most difficult. Is to hold on to that language. And it's ironic because...
I mean, listen, I'm not someone who says that everyone needs to. I mean, I for sure went through a huge season in my life where I couldn't even claim the word Christian for myself because I was like, I can't... That even that word has too much baggage for me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I could not do it for a long time and had to find different ways of describing my spiritual journey. At the core, we're probably still the same thing. It's not like I wasn't a Christian. Right, in the truest sense of the word, but the word had too much baggage for me. And so setting it aside for a time was also really healing for me. And I affirm that for people, right? If those words have been used to wound or have caused trauma, not everybody will have those connections to those words that we did. And there's room for that story too, right? And I think that there needs to be an honor for that as well. I mean, Lord knows that's also part of I think everyone's story, but you know, particularly, you know, I think that's something we share.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, and I think that's one thing we've got to learn is to have grace with each other wherever we are in our story, because we're all at different places, you know, and everyone's different. Yeah, and it's ironic actually. I was going to say that the spiritual community that I found is one that uses like old Celtic liturgies and Taizé and all of these things, which are much older than anything that I've used before, and that I found Jesus there in an Anglican church building as well. You know, it was like, this is weird. This doesn't make sense. You know, it was like going back to the future.
I think that's the thing that's great, you know? Is that you end up being surprised almost by the invitation of them. I don't know. I just, it's like what we were saying earlier, I guess, right? There's a greater expansiveness than I think we've been taught.
Yeah.
What we've been led to believe, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's room. And invitation to it too, right? I think that even that is something that's really exciting to me, is the sense of possibility. I mean, a lot of times people can see that if you say, well, this is my experience, they perceive that as a critique of theirs. And I don't see it that way. I tend to see someone's different experience as like actually really exciting, because I feel like in a lot of ways I love God better. It's maybe not the word truer, more deeply. I'm not sure what the right word is there, but there's a shift in how I know and love God when I hear why and how other people know and love God, especially when it's very different than mine, especially when it's a very different experience, when it's a very different trajectory or history or culture or tradition, right? There's something expansive and exciting about that. Look at all the ways that God is at work in the world. More than we could ask or imagine.
Mm. Exactly, yeah. And one thing I wanted to touch on, and I know it's a difficult thing to talk about, I mean, you've touched on it a little bit already, was Rachel. Because, obviously, she passed away early in spring 2019. And that was, that was a shock to everybody. and there was a big collective grief that... outpouring of grief around that, and obviously she was a dear friend, close friend of yours, and a lot of the, you were talking about the work that you'd done together, and I really want to be sensitive talking about this because it's not an easy thing to talk about, but how did that, going through that, how did you work that through with God? How are you working it through with God? Because it's not a simple process, I guess.
I think it's probably still an ongoing conversation.
Yeah, I get that. I feel like
it's only been 7 months, and as you said, I mean, there's just was a tremendous outpouring of grief, and I felt very protective of her and of her family. Especially during those early months. And then needing in a lot of ways to get through the next evolving phase without her was just felt impossible. But at the same time, the work felt like a gift, distraction maybe, I don't know. And now on this side of it, I don't think I have a whole lot of answers. I have a lot of grief. A lot of loss, a lot of loneliness. I miss her tremendously in every corner of of my work and life. But I think the thing that I have clung to, and this has been my experience, I can't say that this has been everybody's experience, as we have walked, you know, whether people knew her intimately or didn't. A lot of people felt like Rachel was alongside of them, right? That was the gift of her work.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think for sure.
Yeah.
But for me, from the place in the circle where I have, God was with us in a way I don't fully understand yet. And the presence of God was in every horrifying, horrible moment.
Yeah.
And the theological idea of Emmanuel, right, that name of God with us, it sounds so Jesus-y and so Christmassy, became the foundation of my life in these last 7 months. And it's really all I've had. I don't have a lot of answers. I don't have any resolutions. I'm still angry. I'm still sad, super sad. But God with us. Mm. And I think that's the thing that has been my both revelation and foundation for the last number of years, but particularly these last 7 months, is that Jesus, it's not God with us only when we are winning. And it's not God with us when everything works out or when you get the miracle that you were hoping for. It's not God with us when everything is shiny and happy and prosperous and you are well-liked and well-loved and everything is going the way you want it. That the most rich thing of God is that it's God with us when we are suffering, when we are in hospital rooms and at gravesides and at funerals and doing the impossible work of keeping going. That is the truest thing that I have for what these months have been.
Thank you for sharing that. Because I know it's not a difficult thing to talk about, but I wanted to honour her by talking about it, and rather than kind of just brushing over things, if that makes sense. And because it's part of your story as well. And there's a beautiful in memoriam at the end of the book as well, which talks about her, which is really beautiful.
The book was actually on press when all of the everything got very, very hard. And so we pulled it from press just, and I mean, I don't know if it's, I haven't been able to read it since I wrote it, so I'm sure it was fine. But it was definitely in the early days, for sure. I think it was like only 10 or like a week or 2 weeks after she passed away when I wrote that.
But it's beautiful. It's a beautiful ending in a way to the book. Yeah.
Thank you. That's kind of you to say.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the whole book is. It's like a story of solidarity, in a sense, because it goes through a whole journey, and it almost says to you that wherever you are on this journey, it's okay to be here. So.
I hope so. I hope that there's a sense of possibility to it, an invitation, no matter where we find ourselves. Right, because sometimes you'll find yourselves in one part of it, and other times you'll find yourself in another part. And I think that that's what it means to be human, right? I think that's just it. I don't think we become, you know, less human by being more spiritual, but it's by fully entering into the things that make us most human, that we come closest to God.
Mm. So just to finish, what is it that gives you hope now?
There's a lot of things that still give me hope. Sometimes they're big things. I think I get a lot of hope from being around small kids, my children in particular. Give me a lot of hope, a lot of joy, a lot of groundedness. I get a lot of hope from a reframing of the of the resurrection or the redemption and renewal of all things, of it being a moment-by-moment thing, of it being a small outpost by small outpost thing. And so this idea of seeing God and seeing possibility and seeing these little small moments of love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and, you know, even self-control, fire. Like these fruits of the Spirit, seeing these things flowering in the wilderness and people. I get a tremendous amount of hope from people who have no business loving Jesus, still pursuing the things of God, still having an openness and a stubbornness and a thing that I get a lot of hope from communities of marginalized and oppressed people within the church, because their resilience and faithfulness is an invitation as well. Yeah. Not in a tokenized way, like in an actual real relationship sort of way. I get a lot of hope. I think just from every day that you're given. I think if anything these last 7 months have shown me is, the lack of guarantees.
Yeah.
and instead the steadiness of possibility and the gift of today. And that's all you really have.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Well, thank you, Sarah. It's been really amazing talking to you, and as always, and inspiring and encouraging and hopeful. So the book is available now, Miracles and Other Reasonable Things, A Story of Unlearning and Relearning God. That's, you can get that wherever books are sold, and I recommend you go and get it right now if you haven't got it already. Sarah's everywhere on social media, everywhere if you want to find her. I'm sure you can find her. So thank you for coming on the show, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me, James. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. So take care, everybody, and we'll talk again very soon.